ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Love books? Listen to The Book Show or The Bookshelf, or hey, why not both?
Then we want to find out more about you. Tell us what you're reading, how you choose your next great read, and what book podcasts you listen to.
Whether you read one book a year or one a week, your feedback will help us make better programs for you and your mates.
So tell us about your reading life.
Find the link to our short survey in the show notes for The Book Show or The Bookshelf.
This is The Book Show. Hello, I'm Claire Nichols. And have you decided what you're voting for in this year's Top 100 Australian Books Count? Voting is now open. You can find the voting details on the Radio National website. And I know it's not easy, so I am here to help with some inspiration, taking you deep into four classic Australian novels written by four of our greatest living authors. And talk about one of the greats, we are kicking things off with the one and only Helen Garner and her 1977 story of love and addiction, Monkey Grip.
He was 23 then, and maybe, I ignorantly surmised, wouldn't get much older because of the junk and the dangerous idleness in the bloodstream. I hadn't reckoned with the grit, nor with what would be required of me, nor with what readiness I would give it, given it all away. People like Jarvo need people like me, steadier, to circle round for a while, and from my centre, held there by children's needs, I stare longingly outwards at his rootlessness.
Monkey Grip was Helen Garner's debut novel. It was inspired by her own life in 1970s inner city Melbourne. It's about Nora, a young mum living in a series of share houses, and her love affair with Jarvo, a beautiful man in the throes of a heroin addiction. Helen Garner, welcome.
Thank you.
So this was your first published book, published in 1977. Can you take me back and tell me about the woman you were when you wrote this book?
Oh, la la. Well, I could say that the first thing that comes to mind is I was raising a child on my own, and I was living in, as you say, a series of share houses in the inner suburbs of Melbourne. And that was, when I look back on it, it was a time of, I was going to say we had a lot of fun. In the households we did, I loved the households. Those group houses were very important part of my life that I think of with tenderness and gratitude. There was a lot of crazy shit that was also going on though, and those are the bits that when you ask me a question like this, I kind of give a shiver and I don't quite know how to answer it. I guess I was partly estranged from my family, from my own, like my parents, just because they were, I think, a bit horrified by the way I was living. And I'd been married. My child was the child of my first marriage to a bloke who I still have very warm feelings for and have always liked. I mean, it wasn't a horrible smash up. It was one of those, it was a marriage ending type of time, the 70s. Everybody thought they could do what they felt like, and marriage was seen as a bit sort of daggy and I can hardly bear to talk about it, really, just baldly like this.
Well, you talk about the crazy shit, Helen, and, you know, certainly reading it now, reading about this life in these share houses with this community of creative people and the partying and the drugs and the big love affairs, did it seem remarkable to you at the time, the life you were living?
No, it seemed like a way of surviving. The households that I lived in were basically set up by women who were bringing up children on their own. So in a sense, it's a bit strong to say they were matriarchies, but they were certainly we ran those houses in an orderly way because we had children, and the children went to school as every child should, and we had regular meal times, and the housework was shared. We were very big on rosters in our houses, and there were signs that would appear on the kitchen wall saying things like, "When was the last time you saw a man with a broom in his hand?" That kind of rousing what was used to be called women's lib. I just remember we had a lot of fun, and a lot of people were musical. So we were always singing and dancing. And those were the happy times. But I've actually strayed from your question and I've forgotten what it was.
I was just wondering if you thought it was remarkable, if you thought it felt like you were doing something very different to everybody else.
No, well, I don't remember. I was aware that this was not the way of life that I would have foreseen for myself. Mm. See, I was one of the oldest people in these groups often. I would often have been the oldest one. I don't know why that is. In fact, I notice now that when I look at my life that I have a lot of friends who are younger than I am. Mm. I mean, we had to find a way to survive. We weren't going, we had a lot of talk going, like, you know, smashing the nuclear family and all that sort of crap, which I now think is crap. But back then that seemed sort of a bit adventurous. But I don't think we were setting ourselves up to be different. We were just trying to find a way to survive.
You were a dedicated diary keeper throughout this period, Helen, and I know you still are. When did that start, the dedication to the diary?
Oh, I started keeping a diary when I was very young, with some gaps. I kept a diary when I was a teenager. And when I went to university, I burnt them all, much to my mother's mortification. I was throwing them into the incinerator in the backyard. She was dancing around going, "Oh, let me read just one page. And I'm like, "Absolutely not." And I burnt the lot. And then I didn't really start again until, not seriously, I think, until after my first marriage broke up.
Mm. So around this time, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, well, that became, once again, a mode of survival, just a way of keeping my head together.
Yeah, I do think about you taking that time out to, you know, sit down and reflect. Is there a solace in keeping the diary, especially during this period of your life?
Oh, solace is maybe a bit strong. It was just a habit. It was a custom that I'd always liked writing stuff down. I love pens and I love paper and I still do. And I get an enormous amount of pleasure out of putting sentences together. And that's been true for me from primary school. I loved it and I love grammar and syntax and I'm terribly interested in how language works. And so I just got a great deal of pleasure from regularly writing things down. And I had no great tale to tell. So the material I was using as you know, you have to write about something. So I just got into the habit of writing about my daily life.
Mm. And at what point did you realise, Helen, that maybe there's a novel in this? Maybe this is something that other people would want to read about?
Oh, I do remember quite vividly. When I was having that love affair with the guy who's called Jarvo in the book, I suppose it was getting towards the end of the, I can't remember how long we were together, a year or maybe two, and I could feel the story of it, as it were, in my life, the events of my life around this love affair. I could feel them coming around in a curve towards an ending. I could see that it couldn't go on. But I had this sense of the curve of the story. And this is something I'd never really thought about kind of technically because, I mean, I'd read about a million novels, but back then there was no creative writing courses. We just slogged on our own. But I could feel that there was a curve happening. And I thought, oh, maybe this is a story. Not maybe it's a novel, but maybe it's a story. And so I thought, well, I'll just see if I can use the stuff that's in the diary and see if I can get it down on paper and follow that curve. Mm. And that's what I did. And then we did split up and that was the end of the love affair. And I thought, oh, well, I see, that was the end. It's over. And now now maybe this is a book. It was a kind of formal feeling, not a matter of content so much as a feeling of form that arose from the sort of mess of the emotional situation and the daily life around it.
It's a hell of a way to deal with a breakup, Helen, writing a novel.
Well, I think it's probably quite common these days.
So obviously the names are changed in Monkey Grip, but that aside, how much else in this novel is a work of imagination and how much of it was drawing directly on the diaries?
Well, you see, at the time when it was published, and to my great surprise and everybody else's surprise, a lot of people bought it. You know, it was quite a successful book. And this surprised everybody and outraged some people who criticised the book on the grounds that, you know, she hasn't written a novel. This isn't a novel. It's just a diary. She's just published her diary. And of course, I was outraged by this and got on my high horse and I'd say, how dare you? It is a novel. It's not just my diary. But of course, now I can't even be bothered raising that objection. I just think, yeah, okay, it is my diary. I took the diary down to the State Library and I had the exercise book that was the diary, and next to it I had another exercise book, and I copied by hand the passages that were interesting. And I tried to cut out the boring bits and the repetitive bits that were tedious. But you see, when you use the word imagination, that's where it gets all kind of misty, because people have a sense that a diary is like a kind of a mechanical recording of events. Mm-hmm. And it's not. I mean, there's a certain amount of imagination that goes into a diary because you try to enjoy yourself when you're writing a diary. You're not writing in a mechanical sort of machine-like way. This happened. You're trying to make lovely sentences, or you're trying to convey a mood, or you're trying to relate a dream. Things like that are technically hard to do. But you don't think of them as technique. You think of them while you're doing them as just the great pleasure of handling language and of getting out your fountain pen and making a mark on paper. So imagination is sort of I guess invention might be closer to the mark, to the question that you're asking. Mm. No, look, most of it, I couldn't even tell you now. It's so long ago. You know, when I pick up this book, how many years is it?
77, you published it.
Well, see, that's a hell of a long time ago. And I, you know, if I pick it, I wouldn't read Monkey Grip again. I sort of couldn't bear to. I'm not sure why. If I pick it up and read a couple of pages, I think, oh, I don't remember that happening. And yet I can tell that it did happen, or a version of that scene did happen. It feels real to me.
Yeah.
And it's a very hard question to answer. But most of it sprang straight out of immediate experience. But what I'm fighting to say here is that's what annoys me about people saying she just published her diary, as if it just kind of poured out in a sort of vomitous kind of flow without any intellect in it, without any consciousness of shape or form, or without any work on tone and pace and all the things that make a written document something other than just a diary. So it's very sort of vexing to me to think that people are so scornful of a diary as a form. And I think that's partly a sort of misogynistic dismissal. Say, oh, what, she's just a woman, just this emotional rave.
Mm. This is The Book Show, where we're getting ready for the Top 100 Australian Books Countdown by revisiting some classic Australian novels. And with me is Helen Garner to reflect on her debut novel, Monkey Grip. The narrator of this novel is Nora. And we've talked about who you were, Helen. Do we need to explain who Nora is?
What do you mean, who she is?
I would normally say, who is Nora? But we've talked a lot about who you were, and obviously you're so closely entwined. What do we need to know about Nora, the character?
Well, that's really hard. I mean, how can I say, well, she was, I can tell you that she was somebody who, she/I, came from Geelong, went to a private girls' school, It seems interesting to me now to say she went to an Anglican school, so she was familiar with the Bible and the prayer book. Mm-hmm. She'd been to Melbourne University and she had done a degree in an arts degree in English and French literature. So she was, as it were, a fairly highly educated person. And she had been a teacher, a high school teacher, for several years.
And she's obviously got this beautiful daughter, and
yeah, she's got a kid, and she's looking for a way to live where her child will be happy and have the companionship of other kids, because Nora herself is not going to have any more children. She's only got one. And she's gets involved in rather unwise love affairs, put it that way. I mean, there was a time of great sexual freedom. We thought of it as freedom, but I look back on it and I see it as a kind of craziness, wow, really. But, you know, look, I'm 83 now, and I look back on that time of, you know, we thought we could do anything. We thought we should be allowed to do anything. So we hurt each other and we trampled over each other. And we, and I'm talking about Nora too, had very little psychological sophistication. I look back on that now, especially when I think about those households that we had as a group. We're sort of lefties and we were always rushing out to demos, and that was great. I loved all that. But we didn't have any knowledge of psychology. Mm-hmm. And the whole therapy thing, which was happening already, I suppose, in America, and we were pretty influenced by American culture, but the whole psychoanalytic way of thinking was completely foreign to us. And consequently, I think we had no tools with which to deal with problems that arose between us in those households. That interests me greatly, that we weren't equipped to deal with. You know, we thought, oh yeah, we don't want to live in couples, we'd like to live in groups. And we rushed into it, and it was great and we loved it, but we would hurt each other and we would disappoint each other and behave in ways that made other people in the house miserable, and we didn't know how to, as it were, analyse our own behaviour. We had no tools. And I look back on that now with a sort of strange curiosity and regret. I suppose that's what I'm saying. It was a kind of naivety that we had, and we were crashing through our lives, and a lot of it was fabulous. I mean, you know, zooming around on bikes with kids on the back and whole days spent at the swimming pool, and there was a sort of crazy freedom in it, and knowing other people's children, helping other people to raise their children. All those things were kind of marvellous, but there was a darker side to it.
Well, you mentioned the word naivety, and even Nora says that in the book. Nora tells us terminal naivety was my disease.
Oh, is that what she said?
Yeah. So even at the time, that's what you were thinking, Helen.
Yeah, I suppose so.
But can we talk about Javo, though, because she has this big love affair with this man who is a spectacular man, but he is in the throes of this heroin addiction. What draws Nora to Javo?
That I cannot tell you. I haven't got a clue. I mean, he the person on whom Javo is based, the character, is I just saw him about 2 weeks ago, and we went up to Carlton and sat in a cafe, and we just laughed and laughed and laughed. I mean, he's this adorable guy, and he got off drugs and survived it and made his own life without, and he's got kids, he's got grandkids.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, you look back and you think, why was I with so-and-so? And the answer is, you know, just off the top of your head, 50 years later, he was just a gorgeous guy and I adored him. So to go to sort of analyse why you were drawn to someone retrospectively, I don't know. I don't know the answer.
The heroin addiction means it's kind of a lopsided relationship, right? Javo can't give Nora, you know, he can't split his love between her and the drugs, right?
Yeah, right.
How does that leave Nora?
Oh, well, okay, let's look at it this way. Maybe Nora, and I'm going to say Nora now because it is, after all, a novel, she says feebly. No, I mean, Nora was seemed to be drawn to somebody who, well, actually, when you look at my life and you look at those published diaries that came out a few years ago, mm-hmm. How to End a Story, it's a similar pattern, falling in love with somebody who is not temperamentally capable of being in the sort of relationship that I thought that I wanted. So I think that Nora slash I was drawn to a painful, difficult relationships and, you know, you could go psychoanalytical on that, but I'm not going to do that on the radio.
Good call. I loved hearing about the fact that you saw this guy only 2 weeks ago, this guy who inspired the character of Jarvo, and it's so great to hear he's off the drugs and he's well. It does make me curious how the people around you reacted when you wrote this book about all of them.
That's an interesting question. I think, you see, I don't actually remember very much about this, and I have to say that the parts of my diary that covered this period, I burnt them. I burnt them, but not until, you know, a long time afterwards, but I burnt them up to the point where the big published diaries, I burnt them to the point where that begins.
Yeah, where the first of your published diaries, which is called Yellow Notebook.
So I'm just saying this is, I can't look up any of this in an old diary because I burnt several years worth. There's this, sometimes when I'm talking about this period, I talk about the households, mm-hmm. by which I mean the houses in which lived my friends who I hung out with at the time, because there was quite a string of these group houses. As everybody knows, you know, that's what happened in the 70s. But I hope that this is what I did, but I don't know if I did, that I circulated copies around and people were reading it and passing it from hand to hand. And nobody kicked up a stink.
Wow.
I think probably everybody was just kind of really surprised, but not outraged. I can't remember now. I mean, there might be somebody who, having heard this program on the radio, is going to ring me up and say, "What? Don't you remember what I said to you?" And that may be, but I'm just this on the verge of my mind is coming this one very touching memory I have. There was a guy who was one of the junkie crowd, and he had left Melbourne, and he makes a very small appearance in the book. I hadn't seen him for many years, and he'd left Melbourne and gone to Sydney, and people told me that he was working as a taxi driver. That was all I knew. And when the book came out, I got a letter from him, and he thanked me for putting, he said, "Thanks, Hells, for putting me in the book." He said, "It's a little part of my life that hasn't been lost."
Wow.
And I was terribly touched by that. I thought it was really very generous of him to thank me for it. And I've never forgotten it. I think he's dead now, rest his soul. But I don't know. I suppose people weren't used to being written about.
These lives weren't lives that had been put in Australian fiction before.
Yeah.
Of course, the other thing that's amazing in Monkey Grip are all these scenes by the pool. Helen Garner, the hot bitumen, the cool water, and people just hanging out for hours and hours and hours. Why was it so important for you to celebrate that ritual of going to the local pool?
Oh, because of the kids. We were there with the kids. I mean, one time, it'd be 5 years ago now, I was giving a talk somewhere and the person who was interviewing me said, "Now, I want you to read out a passage from Monkey Grip," and she sort of hit me with it. And I said, "Oh, no, it's all full of sex and drugs. I can't read that out now." And she said, "No, Helen, just read out this page." And so she handed me the book. And what it was an account of Nora and one of the men in the household dinking two of the children to the swimming pool and going through the park on the push bikes. And it was so lovely. I mean, I just thought, oh, this is actually really good and it's nice. I mean, I don't go near this book really because I, you know, it causes me a lot of pain and not regret, but just pain. And And so when she made me read out that passage about the happiness of being with the children in the heat and the concrete and dipping into the water and the bikes kind of speeding across the park with a kid on the back of each bike, and you know, they just sat on we didn't have bike seats. We just had like one of those metal things with a clip on it that was supposed to, you know, hold your jacket or something, and there would be a kid sitting on that, hanging onto the back of you. Oh, those were happy times. They were just marvellous. And being at the pool, it was like a kind of paradise, the Fitzroy Baths. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've got to say, this book made me want to go for a bike ride like nothing else.
I can't ride my bike anymore. I fell off it outside the post office and hurt my iliotibial band.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And, of course, famously, you rode the manuscript for this book on your bike to the publisher's office, right?
Yes, I did. Well, and that's how we got around in those days. I didn't have a car. We just pedalled everywhere. And I heard there were these two women who I'd vaguely known them at university, Hilary McPhee and Diana Gribble. They had set up this new publishing company called McPhee Gribble, and I think they'd published by this time maybe one or max two novels by women. And I thought, oh, maybe if I show it to them, they'll tell me if it is a book. And see, I mean, this was before I'd shown it to anyone else who was like in it or anything. And so I just chucked it in the bike basket, and it was the worst piece of presentation of a manuscript you could imagine. I mean, it was single-spaced, quarto-page sizes, bang up against the margin, and it was really ugly. Now I know how to present a manuscript, but then I didn't. So I pedalled along, and they had this office. It was like a converted garage at the back of someone's house. So I just said, look, I might have written a book. Can I leave it with you? And they said, oh, sure, just leave it with us. We'll read it. So, and I wrote it home, and I was so delighted with myself for having actually handed it over that I had this crazy fantasy that by the time I got home, they would have rung up and said, oh, we love it, and we're going to publish it, you know, in 20 minutes. But, you know, it took a lot longer than that.
And, you know, you've talked about the fact that it's hard to revisit Monkey Grip because it's a book that causes you pain when you go back to it. It's also the book that marked the beginning of your incredible publishing career. Can you look at it from that perspective as well as the book that began it all for you?
Well, what I learnt was the second book that I wrote was knocked back by McPhee Gribble for very good reasons, because it was, as they put it to me charmingly, this is shit, Helen.
Wow.
And I learnt the hard lesson that, you know, I was a bit pleased about Monkey Grip. I thought, oh, now I know how to write a book. I might just sit down and write another one. And so I just kind of rambled on, and I tried to do without thinking, you know, I just kept on using the same sort of material minus the drug affair. And I just started to write about our lives, and it was just boring. You know, I had nothing to say in it, and they just knocked it back. So what I learnt was you can't write the same book twice. Mm. You've got to write a new, you've got to be in a different place for another book, and you've got to come at it freshly. That was a bit of a lesson to learn. So my second book is composed of two stories, and they were what I salvaged out of that shit manuscript.
Wow. And of course, you know, the later part of your career, Helen Garner, has been very much driven by non-fiction, and of course over the last several years, the publication of the diaries. Mm. Does it strike you now that fiction was something that was better suited to your younger self?
Oh, that's a nice way of putting it. I see, when I got out of university, having done a literature degree, I thought that the novel was what you had to write. I thought that it was, you know, the queen of forms, and that's what one was supposed to write. So I wrote something which I called a novel, and people accepted it as a novel, and it still is accepted as a novel, which is great. I don't care either way. I just wish people had put a book. I'm not interested in thinking about form as much as I used to when I was anxious and younger. But when I was married to Murray Bale, I was very influenced by his thoughts for quite a long time. I had to fight my way out of that influence to some extent. He had a very strong sense of the hierarchy of forms. And to him, the novel was absolutely at the top. And to me, the top is of literature, literary forms is poetry, which I would not aspire to. But he thought that the novel was it and what one aspired to. But I look back now and I see that two things. Firstly, between books, I'd always supported myself with freelance journalism. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it and I was good enough at it to make a living out of it. And I did that for quite some years between books. But when things got difficult between him and me, I think there was a lot of unacknowledged rivalry between us as writers. Mm. And he thought little of nonfiction, or he thought a lot less of nonfiction. But I sort of twigged late in that relationship that nonfiction was probably my natural form. And I still think that. I think I wouldn't be capable of writing a novel like, for example, his famous one, Eucalyptus, which is, you know, a work of imagination in the way that you meant imagination when we first started this conversation. Yeah. I just don't work like that. Everything I do, it takes its energy and its drive and its urgency from my immediate experience or things that I witness or have passed through. And I think that urge expresses itself more in nonfiction in me. But then I look back and I see that probably what I was doing was vacating the field of this rivalry that neither of us would acknowledge. Mm. So I backed off the field. But see, I love nonfiction. I love it. I feel that it's natural to me. I feel at ease in it. And maybe when you say in my youth, I was still writing terribly close to my own experience, and I always have done. Mm. So maybe I just, you know, the idea of a novel kind of, it always sort of crashes down on you. That's what you're supposed to be doing. But see, when I wrote that book, The Spare Room, if that's called a novel, it's because what I'm saying is there are a couple of bits in this that I made up or that aren't literally what happened. But when it was sort of published with a perfect novel signed Peter Carey on the front cover, I sort of felt really cross. I thought I didn't want to say, hey, everybody, look, I've written a novel. I just don't want to think like that. I just want to say, look, I've written a book and some of it's real and some of it maybe isn't quite as real, but so what? You know, here it is. It's a shaped object in words and I've written it with every bit of skill that I've got. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Well, this is a remarkable book. It's called Monkey Grip. Helen Garner, thank you so much for taking us back to the beginning today.
Thanks very much. It was kind of enjoyable. Thank you.
And how wonderful to hear how Monkey Grip was born out of pain and joy and bike rides and vigorous diary keeping. Perhaps you are going to vote for Monkey Grip or any of Helen's other fiction or non-fiction books in our top 100 Australian books count. Because yes, you can vote for non-fiction. You could vote for poetry, a cookbook, a kid's book. If it is written by an Australian, if it is set in Australia, or even if the translator or an editor or an illustrator has a meaningful relationship with Australia, you can vote for it. You just need to head to the Radio National website and look for Top 100 Books. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, where now I have an unlikely reading companion for Monkey Grip. It's a new book. It's called Blue Giant. And yes, this is also about young people with lots of time on their hands, living in a share house in inner city Melbourne. There's drugs and bad choices. But this book, Blue Giant by Jordan Prosser, it's very much a novel of the moment. This is about Abby and Nikki, millennial ennui, and moving to Mars. Hello, Jordan.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
I'm really well. Did it ever occur to you that Blue Giant could be a very weird successor to Monkey Grip?
I had it pointed out to me because of the number of sequences that take place at the Fitzroy Pool. And I haven't read Monkey Grip for years and years, and so it was sort of a distant memory to me. Maybe it was completely subconscious that I chose that pool of all the pools and leisure centres in Melbourne. But yes, my partner mentioned that to me, the Aqua Profunda connection.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible that this place, the Fitzroy Pool, has been so immortalised in fiction by first Helen and then you. Although I've got to say, your treatment of the pool is really different. Do you want to pick up the book and just read me how your character Abby sees the pool in the 2020s?
Absolutely. Abby paused to survey the pool. Hairy-chested, yellow-capped lap swimmers, the worst kind of territorial lane hounds, hewed their paths between the floating ropes, staking out sacred turf. In the shallow end was an aqua aerobics class, not for geriatrics, but for white-toothed, early middle-aged mums, PTA nightmares, and local council tyrants, the but-first-coffee crowd. A group of three chic 20-something girls languished on pool lounges by the water's edge, nibbling on loon croissants, adjusting their bathers, snapping selfies and filming each other with no intention whatsoever of getting wet.
I don't know that Nora from Monkey Grip would recognise what has happened to her beloved Fitzroy Pool.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Times change. Pools change.
So tell me, this world you're writing about, it's a very millennial experience of Melbourne and share housing. What did you want to look at about life in Melbourne right now?
I think the book really kind of operates in two modes. There is the incredibly hyper-specific, like there's the tram routes that you take to get to work or to get to the pool. There's the IKEA you shop at. There's the 7-Eleven where you get your coconut water. There's the houses where you've lived in the past and your favorite burger joints. But then there's also kind of the greater outer world, which is constantly pressing in on the real world. And that is, for want of a better word, the internet. Mm. So the main character, Abby, is really kind of caught between those two worlds, I think. She's still trying to live a grounded life and exist in the 2020s, but keeps getting sort of pulled outside of herself and pulled into the world of the online world, you know, where everything's a little bit warped, and it makes you feel very differently about yourself and about your place in the world. So that's a tension I feel certainly in this day and age, and I think that's what I wanted to do with the book.
And your character, Abby, she is the most singular character I've met in a very long time.
Thank you.
Introduce us to this very unusual woman.
Ah, oh, Abby Horn, bless her. Abby Horn is 33, the same age Jesus was when he died. she had big dreams when she was in high school. You know, she thought she was going to take over the world. She was going to be a fashion designer, and she moved to Melbourne to study fashion. That dream kind of went up in smoke. So then she quickly pivoted to another. She was going to become a celebrity yogi. She never trained. She never actually took any classes. So that dream disappeared as well. Then she was going to move to Thailand and save the endangered tigers. She moved to Thailand. She didn't save any tigers. And so now she's back in Melbourne. She's lived through COVID lockdowns. She's lived through, you know, into her early 30s. She had a little pot of money, a little nest egg, which she's been slowly whittling away at. And now she's basically at her wit's end. She's more or less given up on life. She's drinking herself numb every evening in order to fall asleep. And that's when she catches wind of an all new scheme, possibly a new dream for her, something that will give her the purpose and the fame that she's always craved.
And I want to talk about that soon. But first I want to check in. How is Abby's mental health?
It's not great. The book talks about her doing her mental health plan, you know, when she was in her early 20s and her friend Nikki sort of being there to take care of her. So it is very much a book about mental health and Abby's poor mental health and her inability to deal with that directly. But it was also important to me not to make it a book that's too quickly pathologizes a character because of their mental health. I think that's something that we see a lot of both in fiction and in real life these days, where as soon as you have someone's diagnosis, you can go, okay, well, I know what they're going to be like. I know what that character is going to do and how they're going to react. And I didn't want to do that. So it's clear that Abby is struggling. It's never entirely clear with what. It just talks about her quote unquote suite of mental health problems, because I didn't want to make it too easy for people to sort of put her in one bucket. bucket or another.
I want to get to the meat of this book now, Jordan Prosser, because our very particular heroine, Abby, has a dream. Well, she has a new dream, and this dream is to go to Mars. What is happening?
So she has learned about a competition, a program called Mars Now that's being run by a Danish tech billionaire named Tor Skovgaard. And Tor Skovgaard's idea is to privately fund a one-way mission into space to colonize the Red Planet, something people have been talking about doing for decades. He's determined he's going to be the one to do it. And the catch is he is putting out an open call all around the world, so anybody can apply. You don't need to be a fighter pilot. You don't need to be an astronaut. You just need to be an interesting person. Because what they're going to do is they're going to beam the footage of the 10-year training program and the 9 months in space. They're going to stream that all back to Earth, sell the broadcasting rights. So it's half space program, half reality TV show. And Abby, in the prologue, when Abby wakes up, she has this dream about winning the competition and living there on Mars, completely free from Earth's shackles. And that's it. She's all in. She's determined to win this competition, come hell or high water, even if it kills her.
Why do you think it's so appealing to her to leave this planet behind?
Because it's two things. It is escape, but it is also glory, right? And fame and purpose. It's both of those things combined. And the idea for the story came from a real life project called Mars One about 10 years ago. It was a Dutch company who wanted to do pretty much this exact same thing. And I remember reading some really great journalism at the time that they announced their shortlist of 100 finalists for their proposed mission. And it was really incredible reading about these people's stories who were kind of throwing their entire lives away. They were so determined that they were going to go to Mars. And when I was looking at them, I again had these two thoughts in mind. On the one hand, I was like, God, you poor idiot. Like, this is never going to happen. Like, who are you fooling? But then on the other hand, God, I wish I like cared about anything that much, that I was willing to sacrifice so much to do it. So it really calls into question, like, where do you draw that line between noble self-sacrifice and just dressed up suicide, basically? And we spoke about Abby's mental health problems before. She does have some suicidal tendencies that the book goes into. And so what are we supposed to think of a person who's like, cool, I'm going on a one-way mission into space and I'm doing it to save humanity? Obviously, there's a part of you that's going to think like, is this just an excuse to kind of be done with it all, to get away from Earth and to get away from life?
I remember the Mars One project so clearly. There was a guy here in Perth who was in that 100 and I interviewed him a couple of times. What I didn't realise was that the whole thing went bust some years ago. It kind of vanished without a trace, right?
Yes, it did. It went bankrupt, officially bankrupt in 2019, but the writing was on the wall for quite a while before that. You know, they'd sort of said that they had contracts in place with SpaceX and Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and journalists started sniffing around, and of course none of it was true. And then other people in this cohort of 100 finalists started, I guess you'd call it whistleblowing, sort of saying, you know, we're being asked to donate 75% of all of our appearance fees in the media back to this company. And they were giving them, within the 100, they were giving them internally rankings, like scores, to determine who was most likely to go based on how much money they donated back to the program. So the whole thing seemed, you know, another one of these kind of like tech pipe dreams, I suppose, maybe started with the very best of intentions, but kind of ended up looking a lot like a scam.
Yeah, I also remember during that period, I was chatting to this NASA engineer, and he was very offended by the Mars One project because of that very thing, that it was a one-way trip. And he said, you know, in NASA, we don't leave anyone behind. You've seen The Martian. We go back and we get them, even though that was fiction. but he found it so upsetting, that concept of leaving someone behind. He just thought it wasn't right.
But what I think is so interesting about that, like, he's very right. That's kind of why this was the point of disruption, if we want to again use that tech sector language. Like, Mars One was saying, our point of difference is we're a private entity. So basically, we can kill people if they volunteer.
Wow.
You know, governments can't do that. You can't send someone to Mars with taxpayer money and leave them there. But here is a company being like, oh, we don't have that problem. We only have shareholders or ratings, you know. And if anything, someone dying on Mars is going to be great for ratings. So we're unencumbered by all the checks and balances that a state-sponsored space agency would be. So I would absolutely be offended too. It's kind of flying in the face of all the work and all the science and all the research and hard work that actually goes into making these things happen so incrementally. And then these people, like we've seen again, the entire startup culture is like just people kind of springing into the scene and being like, oh, we can do that twice as fast for half the price. Watch. And kind of breaking everything.
Although you would never say any of these thoughts to your character, Abby, right, Jordan? Because she wouldn't hear a word of this. She thinks this idea to go to Mars is brilliant.
That's exactly right. You could say them to her and she will laugh them off and say that you're cynical, ye of little faith, you know, why would you say this when I'm trying to actually do something that matters for the first time in my life? So no, she's completely blind to any problems, which are extremely apparent to her friend Nikki, to most other people in the world, and I think certainly to the reader of the book as well.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot of fiction lately about other planets and stories about people leaving Earth for somewhere else. This concept of, you know, setting up a colony on Mars, what does that say about our human inclination to perhaps go, well, this planet's no good anymore, let's throw this one away and go get something pretty and new?
Yeah, I think you've summed it up perfectly there. The closest equivalent I can think is there's a chapter in the book set in IKEA. Mm. And IKEA is kind of Abby's happy place, her safe space in a way. And the reason for that, as the book says, is it's an oasis in the desert of responsibility that is adult life, where it will always be cheaper to start over and to buy something new than to fix what you already have. I think that is a fundamental part of the human condition that we, and it's something that's been brought out of us more and more in this day and age, is this idea of not wanting to maintain things, not wanting to put in the effort to keep things afloat when you can just go, oh, there's something new over there instead. And it might be cheaper and faster and easier. But it's also unknown. You know, we don't know what life is going to be like there. We don't know what life is going to be like in space. Probably pretty dreadful. So why would we not pour all of those resources into taking care of Earth and to taking care of the planet and the lives that we already have? And the answer is simply that it's, you can't market that. It's, you know, ask any climate foundation. It's not particularly sexy or marketable work.
Yeah, I've never heard anyone say that Mars is the IKEA of the solar system, but I really like it. This book is really funny, Jordan. I found myself giggling at so many points in this book, and of course your previous novel, Big Time, was a hoot as well. Why is this the way you approach storytelling?
It's a cliche to say, but you got to laugh or you'll cry, you know? This book was actually extremely hard to write. Like, it was, and it made me very, very sad and very depressed at points. And I think the only way through it is to inject it with this kind of humor. And to be clear, it is pitch black humor. It is taking shots at sort of anyone and everyone, because we're so close to Abby, we're so embedded in her mind. It's this very, very close point of view. And I think just the way she sees the world, it's so sardonic, it's so cynical. She just thinks she's above everybody else. But yeah, I think all my favorite books as well do this, you know, in terms of the humor. I always go back to two of my favorites, Kurt Vonnegut and Chuck Palahniuk, who are writing about war crimes and murder and madness. But they're doing it with this, you know, this kind of rictus grin, you know, where it's hilarious and horrifying at the same time. I want to challenge myself to do something different, but for now it's kind of the only way I know how to write.
Well, I'm happy for you to stick with hilarious and horrifying, because it is so much fun. I really enjoyed this book and I really enjoyed the last one too. This one is Blue Giant. It's published by UQP. Jordan Prosser, this has been fun.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having me back, Claire.
Thanks for listening to The Book Show today. Don't forget to vote for your favourite Australian books of all time on the Radio National website. Huge thanks to Sarah Lestrange. Sarah and I make this program on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.